We are heading into perhaps the most consequential local election in recent memory. Forecasters are expecting big gains for Reform and the Lib Dems and a bad showing for Labour and the Tories. Could we be looking at the end of the two-party system? To make sense of what comes next, please do come along to our local elections shake-up event. Join the Spectators panel and special guests Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg and Zia Yusuf as they analyse the results on the 7th of May at the Emmanuel Centre in Westminster. For tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/local-elections-live.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. Today we are going to be talking about what is now 101 days of Donald Trump's second presidency and what an extraordinary period in American history it has been. The various media attempts to summarise it all seem to fall short because there's just so much going on so many fronts. It is, as my guest today, Victor Davis Hanson, the classicist and scholar, has described it, a counter-revolution, and it's a counter-revolution across all fronts. Victor, thank you very much for coming on to Americano again.
Thank you for having me.
I just want to start by asking you, this term counter-revolution, you've used it in your writing about the second Trump presidency. What exactly do you mean by it?
Well, it's not a revolution. It's not taking us away from norms. The people who are conducting it have called it a return to common sense or a return to the center. But specifically, it's an attempt to roll back the cultural, economic, political, military, diplomatic, social extremism of the last, I guess you would call it the quarter century. Basically, we're going back in cultural terms to kind of a consensus of the Bushes and the Clintons that we were normative. And although MAGA is much different than them, but no other Republican has ever thought that they would address the national debt, the budget deficit, the trade deficit, the woke movement, the DEI movement, the ESG movement, the universities, the border, the deportations, all at once. I don't think Reagan didn't do it even in his revolution, you know, to rebound the American economy and win the Cold War. The two Bushes didn't try it. Romney and McCain didn't run on it. So even Trump in his first administration, for a lot of it was very orthodox Republicanism. This is very different. This is an ambitious agenda to undo a lot of the things of the last 25 years. Some of them we felt were settled. Nobody ever thought you could say that transgendered biological men couldn't compete in women's sports anymore. Nobody thought you could still in the 21st century deport people who had come here illegally. That was sort of taboo in the Western world.
Mm. I mean, you touched on the transgender issue there. I think one of the, for Trump supporters and for a lot of independents too, one of the big, most prominent policies has been this war on the multi-headed monsters of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. How much success do you think he has had? Is it too early to start talking about success? And what are the chances of him winning his war on these various fronts?
Yeah. Well, I think he's at the cusp, and it could go either way. He's got some spectacular successes on the border. We were told that you could not close the border. You had to have comprehensive immigration legislation. That didn't turn out to be true. The border is closed now. There is almost no entries. The biggest problem is how to go about deporting 10 to 12 million people who came in illegally on top of the 20 million that were here illegally prior to the Biden years. And we have a kind of a strange legalistic argument used by the left, and that is, while it's lawful to let in mass people illegally, it's unlawful to follow the law and send them back collectively. They have to be individually adjudicated, they said. So that's a mixed bag. Great on the border. It's lawfare waged on the deportations. Foreign policy, I think it's pretty good. I mean, the prior administration was give Ukraine whatever it takes, endless Stalingrad, Verdun, Somme strategy. And I think now the president is starting to learn that the real obstacle will be Vladimir Putin. And he's talked about a secondary boycott of people who buy fossil fuels from Russia. So I think you'll see some movement there. I think you'll see Iran is in a very different position than the last half century. Its surrogates are all neutered, Hezbollah, Houthis, Hamas, the Assad regime. It's being choked by the maximum pressure embargo. And I think they're going to give it a last chance to negotiate. I don't have much confidence in that. And if they don't negotiate, they don't really have an air defense system anymore. And somebody will take it out by the end of the year. So the foreign policy is pretty good. The biggest issue, of course, is the trade war. And I think as long as the president had stick to these principles of reciprocity, symmetry, and reducing the $1.2 trillion trade deficit and 50 years of consecutive deficits, he had public support. But there's really only about seven entities. He talks about 70 people, 90. It's only seven entities that account for that deficit. And it's mostly the $300 billion from China, the $240 from the EU, South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan, probably $150, $200 billion. And then Canada and Mexico together, about $250 billion. And that's about it. But when he goes into another realm, then I think that has hurt him and accounts for some of the poll slippage of 3 or 4 points. And those are two areas. When he says he's going to have a blanket tariff and that country in particular is running a deficit with us, and I'm talking now about the UK or Australia to take two examples, or Israel, that loses public support. They think, why would you tariff the Brits or the Australians, who are our allies, when we're already running a surplus on trade with those two particular countries. Then the second thing that has hurt him, I think, every once in a while he gets on this cul-de-sac about revenue. Tariffs account for 2% of American federal income of $5.4 trillion. We only get about 70 to 150, depending on the year, billion. But he says if we get a 15% tariff, we could make $1 trillion or $2 trillion over a decade. But you do the math, and it's still only $100 or $200 billion out of $5 trillion. And that doesn't go well with the American people, because they bought into it on the idea of fairness, symmetry, reciprocity as a goal to either lower tariffs or eliminate them. But when you divert from that and say you want to see this as a source of revenue, then in the mind of the American, it's sort of price gouging or it's get rich scheme, and they don't support it. The polls show that.
But what Trump seems to be dangling in front of the American people now is a tax cut, perhaps any day soon, that might alleviate, if not entirely offset, a lot of the pain that might come, particularly in the short term, through tariffs.
Well, the problem with that is, I think, and I support the president, but 40% of American households do not pay income tax now. They actually get, most of them get a credit. As far as the tax cut for tips, a lot of studies have showed 50% of the people who get tips don't report it anyway, because it's easy not to report. So we don't know how big that will be. But the purpose of DOGE, remember, we've targeted about $170 billion. I don't think we're going to get up to $500 billion, but the point of DOGE was that you could go beyond the renewal of the tax cuts and get more tax cuts on things like people who receive Social Security or first responders or military people. That would be stimulus to the economy, and it would be paid for by a 25% reduction in the budget deficit. But the problem, I think, with that is we would still, after running on trying to have a trajectory toward a balanced budget, we would then basically be zero out. Whatever we saved, we would give in tax cuts. That may give greater growth, GDP, and more revenue in a year or two, but in the short term, we'd still be stuck with this nearly $2 trillion budget deficit. So I think a lot of people think, well, we'll just renew the tax cuts. That's good enough. Just make sure we renew them, and then let DOGE cut, and let's see if we can get that 1.9, 2 point, whatever it is, budget deficit down to $300 or $400 billion or four. And so I think what I'm getting at is that slippage is not just the Wall Street hysteria, but it's mixed signals on revenue and tariffs, and it's mixed signals on whether you're a physical hawk and you want to balance the budget, or whether you want to be a supply sider and take a temporary larger deficit in the hopes of getting more expansive growth and future greater revenue.
It seems to me, looking at these first 14 weeks, that the first 7 weeks were this sort of dazzling, dizzying onslaught of executive actions. And a lot of it was quite exhilarating, not just for Trump fans, but for independents and outside observers as well. But the second 7 weeks, I think, have been trickier. And I think a key moment, even though I don't actually think Signalgate was itself as significant a story as a lot of its critics wanted it to be, the fact that an Atlantic journalist, a hostile Atlantic journalist, was included on this text group chat with the top national security team was a major boo-boo, cock-up, whatever you want to call it. And it rather cut away from this sort of image that the Trump administration up until that point had managed to project, which was quite a slick, high-energy, relentless administration. Do you think, obviously after that came tariffs, and that was caused more confusion and chaos and has been a difficult period. I think a fair-minded observer would say it's been a difficult issue for the administration. But do you think, am I overreading into Signalgate by seeing it as a...
I think you might be a little bit. I think what it's sort of T.S. Eliot's dream in the reality. So when, as long as this was figurative and you were talking about these, I mean, Elon Musk was on the stage with a chainsaw laughing about cutting $1 trillion. Everybody loved that. And everybody loved the idea that we're going to get even with the Chinese and we're going to get down to zero tariffs. But once you start implementing that and you start, and the American media fixates on individuals. So you start to lay off people, and then the network news is saturated with a woman who gets on and says, I work for 30 years. I'm a hard worker. I have three children. I'm supporting my grandchildren. And then I've lost my job. And Donald Trump did this to me. And then the next person says, well, I am here illegally, but I've been here 10 years. I'm not on social services. I have a child with paralysis, and now I have to go back to Oaxaca, Mexico. And that was saturated, and that hurt him. And I think a lot of us expected it. I will say that when you look, there's been a lot of writing in the last 48 hours in the United States. These polls that have him down 10 or 8 are really, if you look at Ipsos or the New York Times poll or the Washington poll post, when you look at the breakdown of Trump voters, the Trump voters were almost 50% of the electorate versus 48.5% of Harris. But when you see they are only being polled at 1/3, and then of the sampling, and then more importantly, when I see an NPR poll, I remember the last day of the election, the day of the election, they had Harris winning by 4. Washington Post had Harris winning the swing states. New York Times had her up by 3. And so those polls, I think, have to be diminished a little bit. So it's more likely that Trump is polling somewhere around 45 to 46% approval, not 40. Makes some difference. But the other thing that's hurt him is the Wall Street hysteria. And that, I think, is starting to rebound now in the sense that 50% of all Americans only have 1% of the market capitalization at Wall Street, 10% own 93% of the stock value. So when you talk to most Americans about the stock market, they don't know what you're talking about. They may have 401ks, the 40% have 401ks, but still it's only 7 or 8% of the value. So what they're worried about is inflation, jobs, the price of gas, and that helps Trump. And more importantly, when you look at the stock market, between May and August of 2024, it gyrated right around 40,000, which was a historical high. Everybody was, I remember they had caps on 40,000. Nobody thought they would ever reach that. So what we're talking really is it's about 40, 41 now. So we're talking about it spiked right after Trump was elected to 44. Now it's back to right before the election, basically, a little bit earlier. And so a lot of people think, well, wait a minute. Who are these people to think that when the stock market prices go really, or investment income goes really high, then that's the benchmark for everything else? And they can say you lost $10 trillion. You know, I work at a factory and I made $21 an hour. They cut back, I make $17. I don't think I have a birthright to $21 an hour. So that, I think people are starting to digest that, and the stock market is staging an incremental recovery anyway. So I think you'll be all right. The biggest, I think we could summarize everything is, will Donald Trump in the next 60 days get a big trade deal with either India or Japan or South Korea or Taiwan? And if he does do that, and he gets it down to reciprocity and eliminates some of the deficit, I think you will see some movement by the EU and China. But if he doesn't, and we get into a trade war, he's gonna have some more slippage in the polls. I think there's a 60-40 chance he can get a substantial deal with one of our Asian trading partners, and that will create momentum. And a lot of people will think, we don't want to be left out. But right now, I don't have much confidence in the EU and the United States, partly because they run up also a $300 billion trade deficit. And we're talking about deficits in goods with China, but they kind of work around it. They have about a $240 billion deficit with us. As one European told me, we're not really too worried about China because they have surpluses with us, and we then turn around and have a big surplus with you. And if they cancel 50 737 MAX, we would be forced to sell them some of our Airbuses. So, and they don't like, I think they despise Donald Trump every much as the American left. So I think they channel off the American left, and the American left is telling them. I think Jeremy Raskin was very explicit. He said, any government that does business with Donald Trump will have consequences when we come back into power. Now, he was talking specifically about El Salvador, but I think it was meant to warn everybody else.
There's been this urgency, I'm resisting using the fierce urgency cliche, but there's been this urgency about everything that Team Trump has done in the last 100 days. And the way officials talk is very much that if we don't get it done in these 100 days or in this very early phase of the Trump administration, there's still supposed to be, there is 1,000 days or so left, then we won't get it done at all. And that is really about the fear of the midterms. This is just a recurring theme in all American presidencies, isn't it? That this first chapter is everything. And if it doesn't, if an administration doesn't make huge strides in these first days, then it's not quite a dead duck, but it's not going to make strides further on.
Yeah, and I think it's specifically true of a lame duck president that will not be coming back despite the talk of a third term. He's not coming back. So I think they're also channeling the FDR New Deal 100 days of 1933. They're looking at the 100 days of the massive Reagan tax cuts. They're even looking at George Bush. And remember, he was reelected in 2004, and he was told, when he was inaugurated in 2005, he had 100 days, and he tried to privatize Social Security in the first 3 weeks or 4 weeks, barnstorm, and that didn't work very well. And then the Iraq War kind of undid him. Yeah, I think that's the idea. They have to do it quick, because they understand that such a massive counter-revolution, it's going to affect so many people and shock them. They're going to get a temporary, they hope temporary, decline in the polls. And then these tax cuts, more deregulation, more energy production, $4 or $5 trillion in foreign investment. By the time of the midterms, the economy is going to boom. We've never tried this, really, if you think about it. Tax cuts at the same time of trying to scale down the federal government. Every Republican president, I would think, enlarged, I don't think they quite doubled it, but they almost did. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. They set the precedent, in other words, for Obama and Biden, because they had no fiscal discipline. And it was like musical chairs, that as long as the music was going, you didn't worry about having a chair. But when the debt comes due, and we're paying $3 billion a day in interest, then the music stops, and you got to do something. And I think every president thought, well, on my watch, the music will keep going, and I won't be caught. And then I think Trump said, they despise me. I'm never going to win over the media, the left, the Democrat, but I'm going to go down as a substantial president and go for broke. And that's the attitude that I gather from them.
Well, that fiscal discipline has been a theme, certainly. But as you touched on earlier, the promises of $1 trillion, even $2 trillion, it's still early days, but we're a long way off that. I think Doge has, depending on which report you read, identified about $150 billion of cuts. Is it actually possible for any president, even one conducting a counter-revolution, to bring down not just the deficit, but the national debt, which is now, what is it, $37 trillion?
I'm very skeptical of it. He's outlined $500 billion that could be frozen, that was already approved. That's going to be contested in the court. But historically, and I've written a lot about the economy of the ancient world, medieval world. Historically, when that debt gets so high, there's only two or three remedies, and they're not good. And one of them is to inflate the currency and pay it back, as we saw after World War I, in cheaper dollars on the part of Germany, what they owed. The other thing, unfortunately, is to renounce the debt. We've seen that in Latin America. That won't happen, I don't think. And then the third is kind of the scariest of all, and I've seen some people on the left mention it, where you appropriate private capital and you give them credit. For example, a 401k over a certain amount of money would then be used by the government to pay its obligations, and they would be given Social Security credit in years. They've talked about that. But all of those remedies are nihilistic, and it's the only chance that we have is to grow the economy and have fiscal discipline, and then pay back, get the interest down. What's killing us right now is that we tripled the national debt, but when the interest was 2%, the actual cost to us was no more than the debt was about 10 or 15 trillion. But when you get up to 5 to 6% on treasury bills and things like that, in some cases short term, it's killing us at 3 billion. And everybody knows it. The left, the only other phenomenon I'd say very quickly is I don't remember an oppositional party here in the United States that didn't present some alternative paradigm. The Gingrich 1994 contract with America, or Obama was, you know, the hope and changey stuff, but he did have some particulars he wanted to do, healthcare and stuff. I haven't heard anything from the opposition that says either the border was good, we opened it, we got more people in, we want to come back and get more, or we want to do this on the border, or Afghanistan it had to be done that way, or we're not going to do that again, or this is our plan for peace in Ukraine, or this is how we're going to deal with the Iranian nuclear problem, or here's the new Green Deal, I don't know, Green New Deal, excuse me, 2.0. There was nothing. It's just they look at themselves and they say, we lost the White House, no executive orders. We lost the House and Senate, no legislation. The lower courts will probably be overturned eventually by the Supreme Court. We have no institutional power. We can't run on the 4 years of Joe Biden to return to the good old days, because it was a disaster at the border, hyperinflation, Afghanistan, two theater war. We're just not going to run on that. So what is the alternative is either an alternate plan, but they don't have what you guys have, a shadow government. They don't have people. There's no young Obama, no young Bill Clinton that's taking charge and saying, this is who we are. It's AOC or Bernie Sanders, Heikam. Nobody knows, and there's no agenda. And that leaves just a fourth alternative, and that is the reductio ad Hitlerum. Donald Trump is Hitler. He's a fascist. He wore a blue suit at the Vatican. He's gauche. His wife whispered in his ear something. It's every single day to bring him down. It's almost like a suicide bomber. And now they're using the F word in videos, the SHIT word in videos. They're doing kickbox, 25-hour filibusters, storming Republican town halls, vandalizing Teslas. Governor Pritzker said he was going to be a disruptor and disrupt everything. So it's and the idea is that we don't have any positive thing, but we're going to make it so chaotic that the American people will get in a fetal position, put their hands over their ears, and scream, make it all go away. I can't take it anymore. And we don't care who caused it, but Donald Trump's president. And they're getting emboldened because they see the polls working in their way a little bit.
You mentioned the swearing, and you've written about this too, that the vulgarity of the Democrats, while they call Donald Trump vulgar over and over again, and undoubtedly there are vulgar elements to Trump, it's quite hypocritical now on the part of the Democrats, who are adopting this very coarse style to public discourse.
I think it offends the sensibilities of a lot of people. That's part of it. Is it's reflective of a coarseness of our popular culture. When you see, I do podcasts 4 times a week, and we have kind of a rule that we won't use any profanity or vulgarity on this. And if somebody says hell, we get we get letters coming in and say, please don't use that term. So I try to use heck sometime. But the point I'm making is that the podcast, somehow in the last 5 or 10 years, it's entered in the popular vocabulary, this SHIT, FUC. And they even have, as you say, I mean, the Democrats now have this UN-FUCK campaign on F, the. And these are not just podcasters or influencers on the internet. They're elected senators and representatives, and it's been mainstream. It's very crude, and I don't think the American people, the majority of them, buy into it. It's just so that's what they're doing. They understand that they're repulsive, but that repulsiveness, they think, will be collateral. Donald Trump will be a collateral damage victim of it, because it'll just make everything. Those people will say, oh, I don't know who started this. I can't take it, but I have an idea that Donald Trump is the crudest president we've ever had. Therefore, he must be blamed and get rid of him, or just that is the strategy as I understand it.
When I was young, we always thought of Americans still, and I think this is a sort of British post-war idea of America, as being optimistic, sunny. Obviously, Reagan tied into that when I was young. And then I think over the last 2 decades, it's fair to say America has become a more gloomy place, a more introspective and depressed place in many ways. But what I've been struck observing the Trump administration from outside is that there do seem to be attempts, and the war on DEI, the counter-revolution against DEI, particularly in academia, which is something you know a lot about, is fostering a sort of renewed hope in the American spirit. And it's something that I think foreigners, I know I do, find quite hard to understand. Can you give us a bit of your insights on that? Or do you think I'm just barking up the wrong tree?
I think there's a great backlash that, if I could sum it up in an abstraction, that people are tired of this war on the American past, on impressed dead Americans at Iwo Jima, D-Day, in a B-17, at this, you know, at Bella Wood or at Gettysburg. They're just tired of telling, they're tired of seeing 10, 15 million people trying to crowd in here and then being told it's a horrible place and the founding date has to be changed. So this counter-revolution, actually, the most interesting for me about it is, if you look at the National Endowment for Humanities or the National Endowment for Art or who the people who are being considered, it's a return to classical architecture. And the people will say, the FBI building is ugly. Why do we always like the Treasury building, the Supreme Court? Because it's neoclassical. Or they will say, we're going to restore Columbus Day. We don't care. He discovered America. That was an enormous heroic feat on his part. So it's an attempt to recapture our past, our tradition, our values in art and music. And for the 250th anniversary, they're trying to have videos about great battles in America and the heroic. So there's a sense that we don't have to be apologetic anymore. We don't have to be perfect. We just have to be good. We're better than the alternative, and we're going to restore that. And that that sense, and that appeals to a lot of people because they have family and grandparents. And you know, when I hear every day, and I'm in academia for 50 years, a toxic masculinity, white racism, we're still hearing that all the time from the DE people. And I understand there was segregation in the South and all that, but I always think of, well, I'm named after Victor Hansen that died at Sugarloaf Hill. He was just a farmer, a kid, 21 years old. He didn't bother anybody. He was 6'3", Swedish immigrant family. And he went all the way over to Iwo Jima and fought for 19 days in hell and got killed. Or I think of my father who grew up on the same farm with him, and he never bothered anybody. We were in the Northern California with there was no segregation. My mother fought to make sure the Japanese, she was a lawyer, did not get displaced. She was only 21. And then they sent him on a B-29, 45 missions over Tokyo. And he was never the same when I grew up after that. And so every family has these stories about what the United States did, or people in the Korean War are trying to say, help Europe rebuild or stop the Red Army from going across the Elbe River. But the point I'm making is, and then they hear people say, this is horrible. These people were terrible. They only look at the downside, and everybody said, well, it was so terrible. Why are you so well off compared to anybody else? And why are you so privileged? And so I think the DEI, they think it's the left says, well, this is white supremacy, it isn't. All it's saying is, everybody is a beneficiary of people in the past, and we understand there were, given the time and place, and this was a pre-modern society compared to ours, so of course, a lot of life was drudgery, so they didn't have the opportunities we did for social and cultural reform. But nevertheless, they were better than the alternative, and that's why we're so lucky to have that legacy. And if we don't honor and cherish it, then we're beneath them. And then the other thing is, I think, a lot of people are looking at the current culture and they're saying, you know what, you go back and use the values of the present to condemn the past, but you're wanting your generation. They're going to be 50 years from now, people are going to look at you Americans and say, you had a million people defecating, fornicating, shooting up, urinating right on the streets of your major cities. You had a million abortions a year, 20,000 of them in the birth canal. They're going to go and look at all these things. You let men come in and clobber women in volleyball and boxing and things like that. And I think that's the attitude, that they're tired of this whiny, pampered generation. And I'll just finish this rant by saying, you really see it in the universities. The universities want to fight Donald Trump. But they're like a beautiful, picturesque, mossy rock on a hillside. They look great from the outside, but they do not want to be turned over because underneath it, it's pretty ugly. All sorts of crawling little animals and mold, everything. They have raised tuition double the rate of inflation once the student loan program gave them a guaranteed $1.7 trillion loan portfolio for their students. So the students didn't worry because the government backed their debt. They have charged the federal government anywhere from 40 to 60% surcharges on individual grants when the going rate for private foundation was 15%. In addition to that, they're working around the Supreme Court that said that you 2022 decision against Harvard, North Carolina, said you cannot use race as a basis for admissions and by extension hiring. And we all know that they have worked around it. They have received $60 billion in the last 30 years from illiberal regimes. And just this year, $500 million from communist China, or 2024, and Qatar. And now we learn that they were partnering with institutions in China, Harvard was, that may or may not have been helping to suppress the Uyghurs. So I could go on and on and on. Separate graduations predicated on race, theme houses that are not themed but racially segregated. They're doing all sorts of things that if the public is aware of it, they're going to lose. And they should just cut a deal and say, we're going to internally reform and we need that federal money and we'll try to do it. But if they continue this obstruction, the public will find out who they are and what they've been doing the last 30 years, and it won't help them. It won't be in their interest.
A lot of the power of DEI comes from a kind of tyranny of the mind, and people don't think they can think things or say things, and they haven't been able to. And do you think what's changing is that people now are feeling liberated from that because they have seen that these dragons can be slayed, and in some ways they already are being slayed?
In the case of the university, they have this letter you're all the presidents are supposed to sign that shows solidarity in obstructing the Trump reforms. But it's very funny that there's a lot of presidents, Dartmouth president, there's some here, are not signing it. And the reason they're not is, I think, to kind of transition what you said, they can use the Trump administration as the bogeyman who forced these changes, and then they can internally tell their own faculty and students, we have anti-Semitism and we're going to look for it, but the Trump administration made me do this and cancel the Middle East Studies program. And the Trump administration said, no money, no more Saudi money. And the Trump administration said, we can't gouge the Chinese students 110%, and we've got to cut back on the number of people. 300,000 is a little bit too much. We didn't want any of this, but you can't fight them. And so, I think they feel that they had lost control of their faculty and students at places like Columbia, Princeton, Yale, and they didn't know how, you can't wear a mask. We would let you do it, but they don't want you guys masked at this. And you know what? The Trump administration said, if you go into Columbia and you trash a room and you bully two janitors, or at Stanford, if you ransack the president's office, or you destroy the sandstone columns and you spray paint them, we're just forced to file charges. We don't want to, but they said, if we don't enforce criminal law on our campus, we're not going to get federal money. And so I think that's going on. They don't want to admit that, but from my observation at Stanford, that seems to be what they're really doing.
You talked about neoclassical architecture, and a lot of academics, historians, intellectuals, and so on like to compare the American story with the story of Rome. Obviously, this is your absolute area of expertise, so I'm well aware I don't know what I'm talking about. But if you were to put America right now on a sort of Roman chart, where in the experience of the Roman Republic would you put it?
Well, I just had a debate with my colleague, Neil Ferguson, at a Hoover retreat about that question. And he made the argument, and I want to be fair to him, that Trump was an Augustan figure, an Octavian, and we were at the end of the Republic, and that he was accumulating power. But I politely disagreed, because if you look at extra legality, it was the lawfare that was waged against him, or it was the effort to get him off the ballot, or it was the raid on his home, or it's these lower court judges that are trying to say they have national jurisdiction beyond their region just to wage a lawfare. But what I'm getting at is, we have both sides doing this, but unlike Rome, we have an actual tripart government in the Republic. What killed the Republic was the tribunal courts were weak, and there was a Senate, but the tribal councils were weak. There was no bicameral system, And then you had two consuls. And so they were often rivals. But the biggest pathology was somewhere, I think you could start it either in 146. I think the best date would be 146 with the destruction of Carthage and Corinth. As they started to accumulate these provinces in the Balkans, in the East, in North Africa, they were wealthier than Italy in terms of natural resources, population, and these consular armies that went out there created little fiefdoms, whether it was Marius or Sulla. And when they came back, they were stronger than the Roman Senate and the existing council. So you had all of these people that were freelancing. It would be as if today the senior NATO commander in Europe had an army at his bequest of 400,000 people, and he had income from Europe to pay for it under his direction. Or there was a politician in the United States that had carved out a territory where he had tax. We don't have any of that. So we have self-correcting mechanisms. And what's different right now is, and I think this, it's more specific to Donald Trump. We have never had any president without any political experience or military experience become. And, you know, we had Eisenhower and people, but we've never had anybody from the private sector who has come in here. And then we've never had anybody that I can remember that offended the establishment of both parties. Donald Trump's first administration, there were active cabinet members, Rex Tillerson, James Mattis, Bill Barr at times, H.R. good people, but they tried to stop what he was trying to do or tried to reinterpret what he was trying to do. So we've never seen this level of opposition. And then more importantly, we've never seen a chief executive kind of been a tribune of the people. He talks like the average person. And his taste, we never had a president that would want to be seen on TV in a garbage truck or working at McDonald's or eating a McDonald's burger or going after Rosie O'Donnell or saying that Adam Schiff is now no longer pencil neck but watermelon head. The iconic scene for me is going into Madison Square Garden. It looked like a menagerie. He came in there. He had on one side Speaker Johnson, he had Joe Rogan, he had Dana White, he had Kid Rock, Hulk Hogan, and Robert F. Kennedy. No one would ever have that assemblage around him, that entourage. So this is all new, and what it really does, and to distill what I'm trying to say, is that it is deeply offensive to our bicoastal elite as defined by the people who usually run our government. They come out of universities, they come out of the corporate boardroom, they come out of Wall Street. And when they look at this guy and who's around him, the orange hair, the skin, everything, they get repelled by him. They get repelled by his voice, his looks, the people he surrounds himself with, his vocabulary. And I think we underestimate that. But for the people, the interior that was the losers of globalization, he's kind of a classical John Ford hero, a Sophoclean character. He comes in and he says, "You don't have the skill sets to solve these problems." I do. I do. And they entrust him to do the unorthodox, and it's crude. And then as he starts to be successful, people start to say, "I don't like his tweets." And that's a hallmark of the tragic hero in our fabled Western mythology. We bring these people in, they start to solve the problem, but they do it in a non-couth way because the establishment wouldn't dare use those methodologies. But they work. And I think the Republicans had got to a frame of mind where they would rather play by the Marquess of Queensberry rules and lose nobly under Romney or McCain than win ugly under Trump. That's what's going on with the fascists and the assassination attempts and all this craze. The Tesla, there's just a visceral dislike that these people that support him at these rallies, this, I don't know how, what the base is, 35-40%, these people should not be in charge of the United States. We can send them to Afghanistan. We can send them. They're good when you need them in Iraq. The white male working class died, I think, at 74% of the fatalities in Iraq and maybe 76 in Afghanistan. They only have about 34% of the demographic. So we were basically telling 34% of the demographic, you're going to go to god-awful places and die in combat, but we're going to also say you're suffering from toxic masculinity and your jobs are going to be outsourced and offshored. And that's what it's all about. That group is the base of support, and people despise that group. They really do, the elite. And I say that as someone who's speaking from a farm outside of Fresno where I grew up, but I work at Stanford University on the coast, and I can see it within a four-hour continuum, the people at the Bay Area versus the people in the San Joaquin Valley. And it's like, I don't know, it's like two different worlds. They're not even connected.
That sort of poisonous snobbery that you're describing among the elites, it's something in Britain we might associate with the decline of the British Empire.
I think it is, and it's so unusual because our hallmark was we were not going to have the class distinctions that the British did, that had been toxic to the British and had created a lot of envy among... The old canon in America was always, if you're in Britain and a working class person sees a Rolls Royce, he kicks it. In America, when a working class person sees a Cadillac, he goes to the Cadillac owner and says, how'd you get it? How much does it cost? Does you have financing? And that was our trademark. But I think globalization of the last 25 years rewarded people that had globalized international skills in the media, in academia, in law, in politics, in the corporate world. And the people who were more muscular, those jobs, or they dealt with natural resources or whatever, those jobs were outsourced offshore. And then we created a rationalization. We said these people were deplorables, irredeemables, chumps, dregs, clingers. And we kind of demonized them. Joe Biden said, well, they can always, when we shut down the mines, they can code. They need to be coders. And Hillary said, whether you like it or not, I'm going to shut down West Virginia. She said that in 2000, the whole mining industry. And they couldn't even, Joe Biden called these people garbage. And so there was a sense of that they were the losers and they didn't really know how to deal with the world. And they lacked the culture of the elite. And they lacked the romance of the subsidized poor and minorities. They just didn't have anything going for them. And so they were demonized as losers. And Trump said to them, I am your revenge, I suppose.
Retribution. Victor Davis Hanson, it's always absolutely fascinating to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming on again.
Thank you for having me.
I do hope we'll get you on again soon. All the best.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening to it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.